papers, which I've written with my student Alex Chambers, who has written the simulation code and run all the simulations. It's very good, and we'll be looking for a postdoc in a few months' time. So if you want to have a good postdoc who can do numerical stuff, remember that name in the autumn. Okay, so we have had a few talks already on non-Gaussian energies. I will just quickly go through the basic definitions just so that everyone knows what I'm talking about. So if we have if you have a Gaussian random field, if the curvature perturbations are Gaussian, then everything is described by the two-point function. However, if they are non-Gaussian, there's obviously much more freedom. And when people are looking for non-Gaussian, they obviously have to try to parameterize it in some way. And the conventional way to do that is defining parameter f and l in terms of the three-point function. So basically, it's ratio of the three and two-point functions defined in the appropriate way. And when you do that, it becomes a scale-dependent quantity. In single field, slow roll inflationary models, f and l is very small. And if you go to multi-field models, you can find a bigger values for this. Currently, the observations are not really constraining it terribly much, especially if you compare with the single field prediction. As we heard yesterday, WMAP basically sets those limits, and there was also a paper quite recently on large-scale structure. You can get, you can also try to determine or constrain f and l from that, and you get these limits. And it's interesting if you look at these that it seems to be the central value seems to be a little bit away from zero. So there's at least if you are really optimistic, you could think that there's possibly something there. So what because the single field slower models don't really give you anything terribly interesting in this, it's interesting to look at modifications and ask whether they could give you observable signals. And the model I will be focusing on is massless preheating. So it's basically 5^4 chaotic inflation coupled to a massless scalar field, chi, and you just have the standard phi squared chi squared coupling. And when phi is large, you are here up the hill, it's just like normal chaotic inflation, slow roll inflation. If the coupling g squared is less or of the same order as lambda, then chi field is light, meaning that it's less than the Hubble rate, and then it would develop similar almost scale invariant, almost Gaussian density perturbations during, not density perturbations, similar nearly scale invariant, nearly Gaussian fluctuations as the inflaton field during inflation. And it's possible that they get, so they are isocurvature perturbations, and it is possible that they are converted to curvature perturbations at the end of inflation. In a similar way as happens, for instance, in the curvature model. So really the question is then, how do you actually do the calculation in this case? How do you find the curvature perturbations? Does this happen, and how big the effect is? And people have tried to calculate this before, and what got us interested in this was a paper by Jokinen and Mazumdar a few years ago, where they did basically a linearized calculation. And because this is, because the dynamics is really non-linear, they couldn't give a precise number. But what they wrote was that f and l is large, bigger than 1,000. So it looked like an interesting model to try. at least there's some hope that we could see something there. So just to go through basically what preheating in this model means. When inflation ends, you obviously have the field rolling down here. When it crosses this critical value, 2 times square root of 3, that's Planck mass, draws down the bottom of the potential and starts to oscillate. And then the universe starts to, goes into the radius and dominated era. And the inflaton field is oscillating. Universe is expanding square root of t. Now, you can actually, the equation that describes oscillations is that when you rescale the field and go to conformal time, it actually becomes just the Minkowski space equation, and you can solve that, write the solution in terms of the Jacobi cosine function. And this is a relatively well-known solution. And then the interesting thing is when you look at, so this field is coupled to the chi field, and when you write down the equation of motion for the Fourier modes of chi, again with this rescaling, you find this equation where now have, this is the coupling to the phi field, it has this Jacobi cosine form, so you get Jacobi cosine squared. And so this is just a linear equation with a periodic oscillatory coefficient. So it's basically the Floquet theorem is valid for this equation. It's known as the Lamé equation. The Floquet theorem is valid, and what it says is that the solutions are of this form where you have some periodic function times an exponential where mu, the Floquet index, can be either real or imaginary. And this is, and the equation depends on two parameters, kappa and g squared over lambda. And so in this space of parameters, the Floquet index looks like this. The white regions are where it's imaginary, so you just have a periodic oscillatory solution. But these orange regions are exponentially growing solutions, and that's a parametric resonance. Basically, what it is saying is that the chi field is growing exponentially. Energy is being transferred at an exponential rate from the inflaton field to the chi field. And eventually, when the chi field grows, becomes big enough, things become nonlinear, and then you can no longer use this linearized approximation. Okay, so then the question is really, how do you calculate, FNL in this case, not just estimate it using linearized techniques? And because this is really a nonlinear, I mean, when preheating ends, when the resonance ends, things are really nonlinear. So you need some kind of a nonlinear method. And really, the only thing available is the separate universe or the delta n approximation, which is based on the idea that when you look at two points in universe which are separated by much more than one Hubble radius, they, just by causality, they can't interact. They have to evolve independently of each other, and so it should be a good approximation to treat both of them as independent, separate Freeman, Robertson, Walker universes. So basically, you look at two parts of the universe at the end of inflation, and both of them are described by the Freeman equation, so they may expand in a different way. And the curvature perturbation is given by perturbation of the log of the scale factor at the constant energy density hypersurface. Basically, if you're looking at temperature perturbations, strictly speaking, temperature perturbation of the C and B, strictly speaking, you need to calculate this at recombination. But of course, we know that the curvature perturbation is conserved as long as the system, the universe has reached thermal equilibrium, the unique equation of state, and curvature perturbation is conserved. So basically, it's enough to evolve the fields, solve the Freeman equation from the end of inflation, to thermalization, calculate the curvature perturbation here, and after that, it's going to be conserved. So basically what this means, that what we need to do is to solve the Freeman equation for every point in space separately, and calculate the scale factor at some fixed constant value of energy density, or equivalently Hubble rate. And the only thing that this can depend on are the initial conditions of the fields. There are two light fields in this system, there's phi and chi. So the curvature perturbation can only depend on the values of phi and chi at that point at the end of inflation. So we can, if you assume that we have small perturbations in these fields, as we do, we can write the curvature perturbation, we can basically Taylor expand it. The dependence on, so the term that doesn't depend on chi is just what you have in normal chaotic inflation. So that's well known. It's known to be very Gaussian. So we don't really care about this. And then we Taylor expand this in chi. And because of the symmetry, a theory is symmetric under chi goes to minus chi, the leading term is chi squared. The leading term in the expansion is this, and then we have higher orders, chi to the fourth, and so on. So because this is already known, all we need to do is to calculate the second derivative of n, the second derivative of log a, with respect to the initial value of chi, and that will tell us what the curvature perturbation is. Right, so that's basically what we should do, and this is well known, and people have tried to do this before. The first people were Bassett and Tanaka. Unfortunately, you can't see it here, but what's meant to be plotted here was log a, log of the scale factor, it's a function of chi. What you can't see is that the results are all over the place. It looks like a white noise. Fortunately, there was another group who did pretty much the same simulation and plotted their results with a thicker line, so you can see the results better here. And so you can basically see, so this is the same plot, just with higher resolution, more points here, and you can basically see that it's just looks like noise. It's not smooth at all, and it means that you can't really determine the second derivative, which is what we wanted. So basically, we wanted to measure the second derivative, determine the second derivative of this curve. And in fact, it had already been argued before by Podolsky and Starobinsky that in this model, the dynamics is chaotic, and therefore it's not surprising that this is what you get, because it's chaotic. It means that it's extremely sensitive to the initial conditions, it's extremely sensitive to the value of chi, and this is precisely what it is showing. Okay, so it looks like it didn't work. However, chaos is really something that happens when you have small number of degrees of freedom. And, or to be more precise, of course, you do have chaos, even if you have many degrees of freedom. But if you are only interested in the average behavior, you don't care if the individual degrees of freedom are behaving chaotically. And that's what we're actually doing here. We don't care if the individual degrees of freedom in the universe are chaotic, because all we want to know is how the universe expands on average. So what we decided was to try and make our separate universes inhomogeneous. Basically, it means that we include in the equation of motion the curvature terms. So the previous simulations were without, sorry, a gradient term. So the field equations were without a gradient term. What we did, we included them. So, and then put in the Friedmann equation, we put the average energy density over the whole simulation box. So basically, what we do is that instead of just saying that there are two points which expand according to the Friedmann equation, we have two lattices which expand according to the Friedmann equation. So we do a lattice field theory simulation to calculate the evolution. Now, there are some constraints that we have to satisfy in order for this to make sense. The lattice has to be smaller than the horizon at all times, and that's an important constraint. Okay, so this is, okay, here it's just the parameters that we used. So we did the simulation for different values of initial chi. This is just to show that it roughly works. We start in, when the universe is still inflating, we have a short period of inflation, and then it turns into radiation domination. And evolved it for a long time until the Hubble rate has some particular value, and then we measure the scale factor as a function of chi ini, and we get this curve. And if you compare it with the earlier results, it's just white noise, but our curve clearly has a smooth structure. So introducing these inhomogeneities, introducing more degrees of freedom, made it more regular. And now we can try to go about measuring the second derivative, and we do it by fitting a parabola here, and we get this, for this particular parameter, we get this answer. You might be worried about whether our result depends on which value of h, which value of scale factor we carry out the measurement, but as you can see, it really doesn't. The curvature perturbation should be conserved at late times, and indeed it is in our simulation. And these are for three different values of the couplings. Okay, so this is the second derivative as a function of g squared over lambda. It's the only free parameter in the theory. And you can see that there is clearly some structure there. And especially if you compare it with the resonance band, the Fokker index, you can basically see that there's a sort of growing trend inside each of the resonance bands. And actually useful to, I won't go into any detail, but look at how the shape, if you look at cross sections here, the Fokker index is a function of wave number. Basically, changes first, it's dominated by non-zero momenta, then when we go up, it's dominated by zero wave number, and then go high enough, get the second resonance peak, which starts to be important. And using this, we could actually come up with a simple analytic explanation for our results. It's basically just that the whole result seems to be coming from a balance between the growth of zero mode and growth of the inhomogeneous fluctuations. They grow at different rates if you have this kind of a situation. So the mean grows with one exponent and the fluctuations grow with another. You can calculate when the dynamics becomes non-linear, when g squared chi squared is roughly equal to lambda phi squared, and that's at this time. And this is not really what we ultimately need, because we need to know the scale factor at late times at constant energy density and not when it becomes, when it has become non-linear, but it's a simple transformation. So the scale factor at constant energy density is related to the scale factor at non-linearity in this way. If the equation state was exactly radiation dominated, these two terms would cancel, but during preheating it isn't, because you have the coherent oscillations of the inflaton field, which mean that there's small oscillations in the equation of state, and what it means is that you get a non-zero result given by this simple expression, and when we plot it here, it goes pretty well through all the points that we've got. So it looks like we have basically captured the essential physics, which is in fact very, very simple, and the nonlinearity in the dynamics actually doesn't play that much of a role. There's actually one subtle point here is that our result depends on we can see an analytic result that it depends on the size of our simulation box. And so the solid curve here is for the box size that we used in the simulations. Because infinite volume, it levels off. And in reality, we don't really know what the correct answer is, because obviously you would like to go to infinite volume, but then your assumption that you can describe your lattice as a Freeman-Robertson-Walker universe breaks down because it's bigger than the horizon. So what we can pretty confidently say is that the true answer is somewhere between these two lines, but we don't know exactly where. Right. So this is just the second derivative, which was the ingredient we needed, but this is still not the curvature perturbation. So now we need to ask what kind of curvature perturbation this gives. Weberger and Lyth actually looked at particular kind of perturbations and calculated FNL only for a flat spectrum. In our case, spectrum is not exactly flat, and when you take that into account, you get this expression for FNL as a function of the second derivative. You can see that it's highly dependent. It goes as a third power of this thing. And here I've plotted two lines here. The dashed line is FNL equal 1. Solid line is FNL equal 100. So that's roughly the current observational limit. And you can see that all our points are well above this. Well, in the first resonance band, all the points are well above this. So what this is saying is that in this model, preheating gives you extremely non-Gaussian perturbations, which are ruled out by observations, but only inside this resonance band, and outside that, everything is fine. There's actually another point, which is that because the perturbations are really so huge, could ask whether even the amplitude of the perturbations generated by preheating is bigger than the Gaussian perturbations from the inflaton field. And you can also calculate that. And you find the green line, that above the green line, that's indeed the case. So these points here are, in fact, already ruled out by the amplitude of the perturbations, not just by the non-Gaussianity. Okay, so I think I'm badly over time, so I'm coming to my conclusions. So I've shown you the results for massless preheating, and basically just want to repeat the main conclusions, which is that there's a strong effect. Preheating can, in this case, produce huge curvature perturbations, highly non-Gaussian curvature perturbations, but it's extremely sensitive to the parameter values. So we can't make a general statement. You can either get extremely large non-Gaussianity, or if you're outside the resonance band, you get zero. So it's, of course, bad. You can't rule out, you can't rule in the model. However, in some sense, this is not the main point here. We chose massless preheating just because it's a simple model and there was potential. It was the case where we had reason to believe that there is a strong effect. The simulations we've done, we could basically do the same calculation for more realistic models, and then you would basically expect to have a smaller signal and could very well be something interesting. One important thing that we need to still work on is the box size dependence. So basically the difference between the solid and the dashed line, which can be fixed by including metric perturbations, so that you're not assuming that your whole lattice is homogeneous and isotropic. What is also interesting here is that we actually don't really need to do all these big numerical simulations. We have a very simple analytic model that can basically reproduce them. Whether the model generalizes to other more realistic cases is not entirely clear, so that's also something where more work needs to be done. But so the bottom line is that we have at least we have a numerical method that we can use to calculate curvature perturbation in pretty much any model, and possibly also an analytic way of doing that. Thank you.